right, everybody. Welcome to the Organic Farm Stand, which comes to you the first and third Thursday of each month. It is August 1st, believe it or not. And we are steaming through the summer. We have a perfect summer day out there. We're here with a fantastic panel. I'm going to introduce our regulars, Guy Beardsley from Guy's Eco Garden up in Shelton. Guy, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Well, that's been always a pleasure, as you know, for how many years now? 10? 12?
Yes. Yeah, you're keeping track. And so that's great. I forgot to mention, my name is Richard Hill. I'm here also with regular panelist and occasional co-host, Chris Ferriero.
Hey, Richard.
Hey, Chris. Great to see you.
I'm glad you're back.
Thank you very much. But we have some special guests today, and I'm going to introduce one who came down with Guy Beardsley today, Maggie Tebbets, who is a graduate from the Manhattan College with a BA in Environmental Studies and Management. She's a student of urban farming and soon to be a practitioner of that. She's spent, I believe, a year in France interning and studying urban farming in France. Fascinating issue there, which we hope we have time to talk about. And she's also interning with New Haven Farms, doing all kinds of amazing stuff there. But our star attraction today is our old friend, very good friend, frequent guest on the Organic Farm Stand, Tara Cook-Littman, environmental activist, community activist. And she's the person who spearheaded the campaign for in Connecticut for GMO labeling, got us right to the finish line before the administration shut down the whole thing with the DARC Act, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right, Tara?
You are correct. Thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you so much. The force of nature that you are is always a great, wonderful experience for us to have here at the Farm Stand. We have a lot of ground to cover today, and Tara specifically is here to talk about the issue of, I'm going to see if I can get the pronunciation right, chlorpyrifos.
Very good.
Did it right. I practiced it quite at length last night, which is an insecticide which is presenting great problems across our country. We're going to talk about the issue of the deregulation of that by our environmental protection agency. Yes, it is supposed to be protecting our environment. And we're also going to talk about the campaign that Tara is initiating here in Connecticut to try to block the use of that in our own state. But let's get started, as usual, with Guy Beardsley. And Guy, tell us about how this patchwork quilt of very hot, humid weather and then some crystalline, perfectly dried summer days are affecting you. Not that much rain recently.
Well, I got 2 inches last night.
Are you kidding? Really?
Yep, 2 inches last night. Plus, we had a single thunderstorm right over Monroe and us, and we got 3/4 inch on Monday. How about that one? So we've had over 3 inches of rain this week. And so we're probably unique in that. But so I went out to do some planting today and preparing a row. And the darn tractor started going into the mud. And I said, that's it. So I've got to let it dry out some before I can get any more things planted. However, planting can go on. The only thing we really stop planting are tomatoes, because my experience is that the 17th of July is about the latest you can put in transplanted tomatoes and expect to get a good crop out of them. Now, that doesn't cover anything in the way of greenhouses or so forth, but out there in the fields, 17 July is our cutoff date on putting tomatoes in the ground and expecting to get something out of them before the end of October. Okay, now, one of the big things happening on our farm, and I'm always very relieved when this happens, our 8,000-plus garlic bulbs are out of the ground. How about that one? And 8,000 of them, and we have 5 cookers, black garlic cookers, all filled up, and they are in process. You know, it takes 298 hours at about an 85 to 86 degree temperature for that regular garlic to turn into black garlic, which if anybody has tasted black garlic, they'll know that the bite that you get from raw garlic has been changed when you go to black garlic. and that the sugars in garlic, and most people don't ever even have a chance to taste the sugars, has been caramelized. So you have a very interesting tasting black garlic clove. And that black garlic clove, I've got a little commercial here, guys. That black garlic clove is tremendously nutritious and enhances the immune system to a fare thee well. And my great example on that is one of our longtime customers works in the URI ward at Bridgeport Hospital. And 2 years ago, when we had so much flu and really bad colds, she was taking one black garlic clove a day, and she never got even a cold or the flu, whereas every other single worker, nurse or doctor, got either one or the other. So that's one of, you know, I hold that up as a great example as to why black garlic is so good for you, as well. It tastes marvelous, and you don't get that bite on it, so that means you don't get any aftertaste. Or said, if you're getting close to somebody for some reason or another who, if normally with raw garlic, you really know about it. So anyway, the black garlic is out. It's being matured, and we even have some five cookers working now. So much for the garlic. Now, I tried some peaches this morning, and those that fell off the tree because they were somewhat rotten, because we use no pesticides at all on our peaches, were just fair. Because we've had so much rain, the flavor is going to be diluted, just like it was in the raspberries and probably in the blackberries, although I have had just a few blackberries. I don't know if Maggie's had any of our blackberries or not. I kind of sample them every now and then. And the blackberries seem to have a fair, decent taste. But the raspberries, clearly, both the black and the red raspberries, did definitely got diluted with all that rain we've had. So there we are, back blackberries, peaches, potatoes are fine. We just don't have a huge problem with them. You know, we had almost no potato bug problem this year, and I have no idea why that was, but we don't ask questions on that. We just accept it. And so the tomatoes are coming in nicely now, and we've had to get some extra boxes to hold the cherries and the salad bowl type tomatoes. The big ones not quite there yet, although we did have some big ones today, didn't we? Yeah, right. I'm asking Maggie on that sort of thing, right? And flowers are great. This is the flower season. I got to say, flowers are magnificent. And the bouquets are just, it's the peak for flowers right now and so forth. I'd have to have one sort of sobering aspect of the farm, though, and that is my major baker has left the farm because she's had to get a job which will provide medical insurance. And so she is going up to Post University in Waterbury and is going to be in the registrar's office. And but we have another baker, Tamara, who has been a graduate of the Baker School and is chefing out at Three Bridges right now at But she's also at the farm, so she's got double duty these days. That's Tamara. And so, Richard, I have taken up more time than I should have, but I do like to talk.
Right? Well, yeah, you do, and we love to hear you. But we actually generally have some questions for you, Guy. Chris, I'm not sure if you have any.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. A few things. One is, do you take all your garlic and cook it?
No. We sell a lot of it raw.
Okay, and I imagine
absolutely, because we simply don't have enough capability in the cookers, because each cooker holds maybe 30 to 35 garlic bulbs. And when you're talking about 8,000 plus bulbs, then and that's not counting the cloves, which are, you multiply that by five or six, and so you could see what we got. No, we don't.
So, and I imagine, so whatever's left over, you save for planting.
Yes. When we go through it, we pick out the ones that look the best, have the good definition, the bulb itself is big, And the cloves in the bulb are big. We never plant sliver cloves.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you're selling those at the farmers markets?
We do, as well as at home, right.
Okay.
And yeah. I actually have one other, maybe you can't answer this. I have a pest issue in my yard, and that is a groundhog. And he killed one of my tomato plants.
Oh, they'll do that. They love tomatoes. And
there's
they'll
like
eat
one,
the leaves.
One tomato on this plant, and it killed the plant to get it. and it's like eating the tops, like ate all my, a lot of my lettuce. It's eating the tops of the cucumber plants. And I'm wondering, is there any decent way to control that?
Well, you got to have a heart trap. That's what you get. That's the best way to go at it. Have a heart trap. Get an apple. Cut it in four pieces. Put peanut butter on all four pieces. Put one piece outside the trap. Another piece just at the entrance of the trap. The third piece just close to the trip, but on the outside side of the trap. And then the last piece is the other side of the trip, so that he has to trip it to get into the last piece of, and so that'll get him. That will take him down. It will also, however, catch skunks and raccoons. And so, which, if you have a skunk, now
I have those also.
Yeah,
but I'm not worried about those. The skunks just dig up the grubs and stuff, and raccoons.
Well, the skunk will get in a trap because peanut butter and skunks go along together pretty well.
Mm.
Now, here's what you do: if you get a skunk in a trap. And this goes to everybody. You take a tarp that is a permeable tarp, a tarp that's impermeable, right? Hold it up and just gently walk toward the trap and talk to the skunk while you're doing this. Now, skunks normally are nighttime creatures, but you're talking now daytime. And so they're in a trap daytime. And just continue to talk to the skunk in a very low tone. Tell the skunk what a good skunk it is and so forth. And then just as you get up there, just cover the trap very gently with the tarp so that it's dark inside. And that relaxes the skunk because it then becomes nighttime for the skunk. And then you can pick up the trap with it covered and move it however you ought to move it.
Mm.
Of course, letting it out of the trap might be an issue.
Yeah, well, you have to be careful about that, Rich, as you can well imagine, right? But we've done it many times.
So they don't mind car rides then?
No, doesn't seem to. Don't okay. See, as long as they stay covered, as long as it stays, in other words, keep them covered.
Right.
That's right, because they think it's nighttime. I mean, that's we're trying to convince them it's nighttime, right.
So is there anything, to wrap it up quickly, anything aside from have a heart trap? I mean, maybe some kind of. It's like I prefer not to trap an animal, and I don't have a trap. So some kind of like chicken wire maybe around the garden. Or,
well, if you want to get physical on that, you got to get to keep
work.
Them out of it. Yeah, you got to have a fence. Doesn't have to be tall, but it has to go underground.
Yeah, I know, because they dig.
Oh, they're very good diggers, absolutely, right.
Okay, well, thank you.
And I'm sorry we took off so much time. I do like to talk about those things.
We do have a skunk who comes and goes every night. We're going down the skunk hole as opposed to the rabbit hole here. But why are they spraying at night? Are they being threatened by an animal?
That's it. That is exactly it.
Okay.
They are threatened by something.
Uh-huh.
And could be an animal, could be an owl, it could be anything like that. They definitely do let fly, and that's a very sulfurous smell. In case you wanted to know what it's all about. And you certainly don't want to get it in your eyes. Dogs definitely do get it in their eyes. And, of course, at that point, they become less than useful. Right? Now, tomato juice is a traditional way of kind of, modifying the smell. If you get it on something, a tomato juice wash or bath or is a pretty good way to go.
Yeah, take the bath in the tomato juice while you're drinking half a quart of vodka. I think it's probably the way to. I actually got directly sprayed by a skunk when I was in, I think, third grade or something like that.
You never forgot it, did you?
I never forgot it. It was a near-death experience. I went to school the same day, and that's where I developed my character. That day, I evolved. Anyway, a question for you, Guy, before we move on to our special guests today. How are your blueberries doing?
Blueberries are pretty much finished now. We've had them for now a month. And, you know, the blueberries are really good, but they're just about finished. Plus, we've had a lot of assistance from the birds on the blueberries. And so, but nevertheless, we've had a lot of blueberries, and they've been great. I have no complaints whatsoever on the blueberries. And so now we feed the birds a lot, so they don't necessarily give us too much trouble with the blueberries. But nevertheless, they'll go after anything that's in fruit. The peaches are particularly bad with the crows. But anyway, you asked about blueberries, and so that's the answer.
Well, it's interesting because I think we both said we're having a very good season with blueberries. I only have three bushes, but the two larger ones were like replete, you know, laden with berries. And they kind of, I still have one bush that has probably the majority of the berries are still unripe, gets a little less sun, the best of it. But I was happy to share this year because we do have the blueberries and we had a very good currant bush this year as well. And the birds didn't get any of those. But the wineberries have been fantastic. If the longer you wait, the better. The tendency is to pick them sooner so the birds don't get them. But the birds know best. They know that the longer they're, you know, ripening and dark, the darker they get, that's when they really get sweet. So I did get my share of those. I think we're ready to move forward. Guy, thank you for the small farm report.
More than welcome, sir.
Yes, indeed. Well, let us move to our special guest, Tara Cook Lippman, with Star Billing today. Tara is an environmentalist. She is a community activist, and we know her so well from her campaign in Connecticut to obtain GMO labeling at the state level. But Tara, on July 17th, the Environmental Protection, I underscore that word, Protection Agency, issued a ruling allowing for the commercial use of chlorpyrifos on corn, soybeans, fruit, and nut trees, Brussels sprouts, cranberries, broccoli, and cauliflower, etc. What is chlorpyrifos, and why should we be alarmed at the EPA's decision?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really so grateful to you for having me on the show. And I just have to mention that my family, who is listening, texted me that they want some of Guy's garlic, and they really appreciated the skunk advice. So chlorpyrifos is a toxic chemical known to harm children. It causes brain damage in children. It causes cancer. And the federal government has completely abdicated its duty in allowing chlorpyrifos to continue being used. During the Obama administration, the EPA was actually trying to do its job and came out with a ruling that there was literally no safe level of chlorpyrifos for any use. And the EPA was set to move forward with a ban. Unfortunately, when the Trump administration came in, the first thing they did, the EPA, was roll back that ban. We then ended up in the courts. Some great organizations led that charge. And the courts essentially said, EPA, you must come out with a final ruling on what you're going to do. What you're reading is their final ruling where they're saying, nope, we are not banning chlorpyrifos. It's frightening to me that this is being used at all. I know for a fact that it's being used actually on golf courses across Connecticut because I spent time at Deep going through pesticide filings. So if you're a golfer, be careful. Make sure you wash your hands and are careful because chlorpyrifos is being sprayed all over golf courses. During the campaign this past session to ban chlorpyrifos in Connecticut, we had a bill that got out of committee and we were moving forward. And then the Farm Bureau came out in strength to block the bill, claiming that their apple growers still needed chlorpyrifos, that tobacco growers, vegetable growers, that they needed it in their arsenal. And so you bet that there are still farmers in Connecticut that are using chlorpyrifos, and that's scary.
So tell us a little bit about the process by which the EPA, the Obama administration, as you said, we're going to attempt to phase it out.
Correct.
Under the EPA. And that was based on research that the EPA scientists were doing on this.
Yes.
So what were they discovering about this chemical that led them to recommend to their agency that
they
ban it?
So first of all, it's really important to know that in 2001, chlorpyrifos was banned from indoor use. So we're now in 2019, and we've known for 18 years that chlorpyrifos was too dangerous to use inside. So the EPA's own scientists, as you mentioned, conducted decades worth of studies where they actually studied urban use of chlorpyrifos as well as studies on farmland, people that lived near farmland. And what the studies suggested, as I mentioned earlier, that any level of chlorpyrifos is dangerous for children, causes brain damage, developmental delays, and also causes cancer. So I'm not going to list all the studies, and I certainly don't have them in my mind. But anyone that's interested, if you just do a simple Google search, you will be able to come up with countless studies proving that chlorpyrifos is a toxic chemical that has no place at all in our environment and certainly not on our food. And that is why I need help in Connecticut to pass a bill to get it banned. And I'm already recruiting Maggie, and I'm going to work on New Haven Farms to get them involved.
Well done. So we know from the articles that I've been reading and that you've brought us with you today that chlorpyrifos is a it attacks the nervous systems, right?
So chlorpyrifos is part of a class of chemicals called organophosphates. Organophosphates in general are quite a dangerous class of chemicals, and were created, and this is not conspiracy theory, this is fact. Organophosphates were created in Nazi Germany during World War II to poison people. And now those same companies are using it on our food. So, yes, they are meant to attack the nervous system of bugs and kill the bugs. And so the same thing is happening to humans when we're exposed to chlorpyrifos. Now, I don't know if anyone has seen the stories that have been coming out of the Dominican Republic, but it's actually suspected that organophosphates have been poisoning tourists there when they spray organophosphates in the hotels there, just something to be aware of. There was a big CNN story, I think only about 6 to 8 weeks ago, that might be of interest to people.
Whoa, that's a caution right there. So when you book your Airbnb vacations, you might want to check and see if that's on their list of cleaning products. So we know that this is a dangerous chemical. What are the options for the Connecticut Farm Bureau and for these farmers that you mentioned, tobacco and other crops in Connecticut? I mean, are there alternatives that would accomplish the same thing?
That is such a great question and something that we were trying to get across to legislators during the last session. There are many alternatives. And in fact, we spoke directly with the Connecticut Experimental Environmental Station, which is located in New Haven, actually, to ask them about what alternatives are. And their exact quote was, this will not be an undue burden on farmers. There are, I actually, on the sheet that I brought you, lists a bunch of different options. I'm sure you're familiar with dogwood borer. That's one of the things that farmers are complaining they need chlorpyrifos for. And so specifically, we wanted to know, what can you do to stop that? So we got information from the UConn Integrated Pest Management Program. We got information from the UMass Extension. And there are plenty. So I'm just going to go through some of them. Plenty of things that they can do. First of all, just maintaining the health of the tree is one of the most important things that they can do. And Guy can certainly talk more to that, but it means fertilizing well, pruning, watering during the dry season, just care of the trees. They also say that you can apply a barrier on the trees of like a white latex paint to the bottom of the tree. And then that is another, you know, perfectly harmless alternative to using chlorpyrifos. And then also there are other safer, more environmentally friendly pesticides that can be used in case of emergency. Chlorpyrifos is just one that should not be used. So there are plenty of alternatives. And the one thing that I want to mention that we found so fascinating is that when we called the apple growers in Connecticut, they said they're not using chlorpyrifos anymore. So it was a really big shock to us that the Farm Bureau was then claiming that the apple growers still needed it when they weren't, because many of the apple growers in Connecticut have acknowledged they're moving beyond chlorpyrifos. One other thing to mention in terms of needing chlorpyrifos. New York passed a ban on chlorpyrifos the last legislative session. California's Environmental Protection Agency came out and said they are, in fact, banning chlorpyrifos. They're moving forward now. And Hawaii passed a bill to ban chlorpyrifos. Now, New York, California, and Hawaii are much bigger agricultural states than Connecticut. So my question is, if those states can do it and their farms are okay, why aren't Connecticut farms okay?
Is chlorpyrifos sold for, you know, individual household use?
No. Individuals can't, for instance, like Roundup, you can't go to Home Depot and buy chlorpyrifos. Only companies and farms are allowed to use chlorpyrifos still.
So they have to be a commercial establishment.
Correct.
That has
to be commercial.
Like a commercial, say a lawn care company.
They can use
where
it.
Where they have the license for the chemicals.
Yes.
Okay.
What about at the state level? Does the state use it on any of the public lands, on the roadside strips next to highways, or in any other public spaces?
So that's a great question. I'm actually not sure of that answer. It's something that we'd have to do a FOIA request for, Freedom of Information Act, to find out if they do. The one thing that I can tell you is it's very difficult to get information in Connecticut from DEEP about who is using chlorpyrifos or any other chemical for that matter and where, because DEEP simply doesn't have the funding to synthesize the information they're getting, keep track of it, organize it. So I did a FOIA request because I wanted to know exactly who's using chlorpyrifos in the state. So I went to DEEP and they plopped mail bins filled with pesticide filings on the table in front of me. completely no organization. And so I started going through the mail bins, and that was how I discovered that, in fact, there are golf courses using it. I actually didn't come across any farms using it, but I only made it through one quarter of one mail bin before I said, this is insane. There has to be a better way. And right now in Connecticut, there simply isn't.
Interesting. Well, can you just guesstimate the exposure of kids to this chemical in perhaps the Northeast? I mean, if maybe you have some information from other states that motivated, for example, New York to ban it, but also other states in our region and in Connecticut. To what extent are kids actually coming in contact with this chemical? Do you have information about that?
I don't have specific information about that, because it's so difficult to figure out where it's being used. So just so you know how it works at DEEP, and I haven't done any work in other states to this point, companies have to file that they're using a certain chemical, but they don't have to indicate where they're applying the chemical. So it would be impossible to know exactly where and how much they're being exposed to. But I would just heed caution to anyone that lives near a golf course or a farm right now that they should find out for themselves, approach those commercial institutions and ask them if they're still using chlorpyrifos. Because if you live near a place that is, then you are being exposed.
Great idea. This is an odd left field question, but do you have any information about marijuana growers, medical marijuana growers in Connecticut, what their pesticide usage is? And I'm not sure what the growing practices are. I think a lot of it is indoors, so they may not confront these issues. But do you have any information about that?
That's a great question, and it's really not my area of expertise. But it was my understanding that the Connecticut medical marijuana growers are not really allowed to use any pesticides whatsoever in their growing practices. Maybe you know differently, but that was my understanding.
I don't know specifically, but I have heard people that are very focused on that issue say they are concerned about pesticide use, chemical uses.
As they should be.
Yeah, in Connecticut. So I think that's a question that needs to be worked. And, you know, as this whole issue of recreational marijuana sweeps the nation, I think those questions are going to be very, very germane.
In Connecticut, if I can just add, better get with the program, or Connecticut residents are just going to continue going to Massachusetts and New York maybe next. And, you know, they had a chance to pass a recreational marijuana bill this past session and didn't, for a supposed progressive state that can't pass marijuana legalization, can't ban chlorpyrifos. You have to start to wonder who we're electing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that raises the question about the Farm Bureau. Now, we know at the national level, the EPA, which whose previous administrator was Scott Pruitt, whose buffoonery and corruption were so manifest that he was frog marched out of that agency even by the Trump administration. But the current administrator of the EPA, Andrew Wheeler, was a former coal industry lobbyist. What do we know, or can you share any information about the influence of money on the EPA from big industries that are actually shaping these kind of policy decisions? And does that filter down, let's say, at the state level to the Farm Bureau?
So this is such a big topic, right? Because we know that money in politics is at the root of so many of our problems, our environmental problems, our pharmaceutical problems. This is huge. And so, yes, it does filter down to the Farm Bureau. The Farm Bureau is funded by the very people that are getting into the EPA and running the EPA. The Farm Bureau is funded by the Monsantos of the world and the Dow Chemicals. They receive money for their operations from Big Ag. So, of course, they're going to be a front for Big Ag's positions on these issues. And the most fascinating part of working at the state level is when I speak with people working in other states, right? The arguments that the Farm Bureau is putting forward are the same arguments that are being told in other states as well. And it's because there's someone in Big Ag who is filtering down the arguments that they want their folks at the different states making.
Mm, mm. Guy Beardsley, you have a deep knowledge of the Farm Bureau, no doubt. What's your take on the Farm Bureau's attitude toward organic farming, their support for organic farming, research on these questions? What's been your experience with that?
Well, I've talked with the Farm Bureau people and they that set up the departments and the subcommittees and so forth. And I was trying to get at that time the Farm Bureau to just appoint a subcommittee, which would be the smallest committee of organics. And they wanted nothing to do with it. They absolutely did not. They wanted to just concentrate on their dairies. And at that time, and this was about 4 years ago now, I have no confidence that the Farm Bureau is interested in even now, after these, all the people are, all the major, Kmart, or not Kmart, but Big Y and Stop and Shop and ShopRite, all have an aisle of dedicated to organics. And, but the Farm Bureau is just simply not involved with organic interests. Somewhere along the line, they might become, and it will probably require the Department of Agriculture's commissioner to push it on down to them as opposed to bring it on up to them. I think it's going to have to be pushed down to get it done.
So, and Guy, one of our problems in Connecticut is that the former executive director of the Farm Bureau is now the commissioner of agriculture in Connecticut. His name is Brian Hurlburt. So he literally went from being the executive director of the Farm Bureau to being the commissioner of agriculture in Connecticut. So and the agriculture commissioner in Connecticut always has seen themselves as a as the person who advocates for farms in Connecticut. And so they are just going to side with the Farm Bureau no matter what until we get somebody into the commission that actually sees the bigger picture. Because for me, I feel like if the agricultural commissioner really wanted to help the farms, right, and didn't want to just dig their heels in beside the farms, they would say, well, times are changing. And so let's move with the times. And I want to help these farms transition from the chemical agriculture to more organic practices. But that's not what they do. But if they really were looking out for the best interest of the farms, that's what they would be doing. And that's a much larger conversation, but it's a conversation that I'd really like to be having in Connecticut. Why is the Commissioner of Agriculture digging their heels in with the Farm Bureau rather than saying, wow, this could be a great opportunity for Connecticut to be a leader in sustainable agriculture? There are so many farms doing it on their own, but it's holding us back when the Commissioner of Agriculture is still so tied to the Farm Bureau and to chemical agriculture.
Well, that's exactly our experience, Richard.
Yeah, I needed your feedback on that guy. Well, you're listening to the Organic Farm Stand on WPKN in Bridgeport. My name is Richard Hill here with Chris Ferriero, Guy Beardsley, Maggie Tebbets, and Tara Cook-Littman, who is giving us an incredible course here in the issue of chlorpyrifos. Oh, my God. I screwed it up again.
Trust me, I practiced for months, and with legislators, it was a really great way to start the conversation because I would say, have you heard about the bill to ban chlorpyrifos? Pure what? So I tell them, I've practiced for 6 months to be able to pronounce this the right way.
It's a challenge. Maggie, what are your thoughts as listening to this conversation? You're interning with the New Haven Farms in urban farming. You've done some work in study in France on this issue. Just what's your reaction to this whole issue? I mean, I presume, given that your association with Guy Beardsley, that you are focusing whenever possible on the organic or alternative, and the notion that these proven toxic chemicals are entering our food stream and affecting young children. What's your reaction to all this?
It's absolutely terrifying. And to think that children are just coming in contact with this more and more just makes you think about who's running the whole business. But yeah, in urban agriculture, for as many practices that I know, most of them are pesticide-free because you're already in an urban setting. You don't need to add more pollution or pesticides to the surrounding areas. That's not the whole point of it.
Maybe give us a sense of what you did in France, I think in Rouen? Rouen?
Yes, Rouen. It's the capital of Normandy. I went to a university called Uni La Salle. And the program is an international program, and it's to get my Master's of Science in Urban Agriculture and Green Cities. And I took courses there for about 8 months, and we had courses on all different types of things. It was very intersectional. So we had courses on sociology to see how people act in cities. We had courses on agroecology, permaculture, all the good stuff. And we were only an hour away from Paris, so we were able to see about 8 different urban farms in Paris, which is very eye-opening since they're one of the leaders in Europe for urban farming.
So one of the roles and goals of urban farming is to try to bring healthy food into cities, which are often described as food deserts, especially specific neighborhoods.
Yes.
Like, for example, in Bridgeport and in New Haven. To what extent do you see this urban farming movement actually being a part of a social and cultural movement to change the imbalance in what urban working class and poor people really have to deal with, grappling with in terms of just being deprived of a healthy diet?
Yeah, I think urban farming is the true solution to that in cities. And I'm working in New Haven right now, but specifically in Fairhaven, which is the more, I would say, impoverished part of New Haven that most people don't really hear about, except for crime or whatnot. And we have 8 different locations across Fairhaven, and it's mainly community-based agriculture. So we include the community, we have a health-based wellness program, and we just try to tell them that this is the right thing. You guys can come out here, farm with us whenever you want. We have Spanish speakers. We have a whole program in Spanish, so since most of them are Spanish speakers there in Fairhaven. And it's true, it is a food desert. As I'm driving around Fairhaven every day, you barely see a grocery store or fresh food. And so the only way for them to eat healthy is to grow it themselves.
Interesting. And so what percentage do you think of the neighborhoods is actually involved in creating the food and growing the food and also in consuming it?
It's definitely not a big percentage right now, and our goal is to get more community involvement. Our biggest group of people is the health-based wellness program, where surrounding physicians or doctors from Yale or St. Ray's are referring people to our program who have like diabetes or a heart condition. And we're saying, we know you live in this food desert. We want to make it easier for you. We're going to set up a nutrition class for you. We're going to give you all the vegetables for free that we grow every day. And it's simple. It doesn't have to be expensive. And there are farmers markets all throughout New Haven, of course. But we specifically do not sell our produce at any of the farmers markets because it's tailored to people with a higher income. And we want to appeal to those who don't have it all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Fantastic. That's really amazing. Yeah, so I think this urban farming thing is, as you pointed out, the wave of the future to solve not just the issue of advancing the notion of organic, natural food production, sustainable food production, but also to solve the socioeconomic issue that is confronting our cities.
Yeah, there's many benefits, too, like green roofs. It'll be better for the planet in total.
You know, interesting thing happened in the Tuesday night Democratic debates. I don't know if, did you see them, Tara?
Not all of them, but some.
Did you hear when there was one candidate, maybe we'll do a little contest here and see if anybody can remember who it was, somebody who brought up the issue of regenerative agriculture in the Midwest. Did you hear that, Chris?
No, I didn't listen.
Did you hear that, Tara?
I didn't hear that part, but if I had to try to guess, I would guess maybe it was Marianne Williamson.
Yeah, I was going to say that also.
Actually, it wasn't. It was Tim Ryan.
Yes. Well, he has a book called Real Food, actually, and he's very into that, so that doesn't surprise me.
Well, it was amazing. I quite honestly, I was like, my jaw dropped, and am I really hearing this? So he was talking about the idea. He actually introduced it as a policy plank, you know, what I will do if I'm president. And he said that a lot of Midwestern farmers, these big, soy and corn farms, and they want to sequester carbon. They want to keep the carbon in the soil. They want to have help in doing that, and that there should be a federal program to promote that in these giant agribusiness farms. Thought that was fascinating that a political candidate, certainly not the most progressive on the dais there, was bringing that up and raising it as an issue. No, I think all the other candidates probably were like, huh, what's he talking about? You know?
That's fantastic. It's so nice to hear them talking about food, because the way we grow our food and what we eat is so missing from so much of the conversation, from the climate change conversation, although you are starting to hear that more. It's also missing from the healthcare conversation. Mm-hmm. When we talk about how much Americans are spending on healthcare and trying to solve this problem, and they're always focused on insurance and Medicare for all. I wish they would start to talk about how we can change our habits and what we're eating and how we're growing our food to help our health, because then it would bring down overall medical costs in general. And that is just completely missing from the conversation. It frustrates me, which is why I didn't listen to all of the debates.
Right. And also, you know, prescription drugs, you know, that's like the, you know, the common medical treatment, you know, just take these pills, you know, work on that one symptom rather than curing the, you know, the disease.
You're right that Marianne Williamson would have been the one to mention. And she did, in fact, talk about the notion that we need a wellness care. I don't know how she phrased it, but it was like, basically, what we have now is a system to treat you after you're already sick, as opposed to a system to
keep us healthy.
To keep us healthy, to promote resistance to illness.
We need black garlic on that, you know, Richard. Right.
Well, and we need more Maggie's. I love what Maggie is doing. I mean, truly, what you're doing is amazing. You're getting right at the root of some of our issues. Thank you.
Well, we're coming down the home stretch here, and I want to give Tara Cook-Littman another shot at just sort of summarizing the struggle that we're in Connecticut. In terms of this issue at the state level, where does the struggle for banning these harmful chemicals go next? What's maybe an update on the GMO labeling issue?
Oh, GMO labeling. I mean, the quickest update is to say that there is no GMO labeling. The DARC Act is still being worked on, but even if they ever finalize that, it's never going to give us true transparency in our food. At this point, for me, I have completely not given up. I'm just waiting until a strategic time to go back at that issue. And right now, obviously, is not the strategic time. But I do believe there will be a time where we can. And in the meantime, we continue educating people about GMOs and how to make better selections for themselves. So that's GMOs. And then in terms of chlorpyrifos, right now we're just working on building our coalition. That's why I said I need to recruit Maggie and other people, because that is exactly what we're doing right now, so that when the legislative session starts again in February, we'll have a stronger group of nonprofits and activists to really push it over the finish line this year. I'm very hopeful that we can have success and ban chlorpyrifos in Connecticut this year. So from now until February, we'll be building the campaign, and then in February the session starts, and we'll have from February to May to pass the bill.
Who were your allies in the legislature on this issue?
Some extremely wonderful legislators. One of them is a Fairfield state rep, Kristen McCarthy-Vahey. She was fantastic. And then a legislator who's actually the chair of the Environment Committee, Mike D'Amico. He's from the Farmington area. He was absolutely fantastic as well. I would say the two of them were two of our biggest champions in the House. And then in the Senate, you're probably all familiar with Will Haskell, who was the 22-year-old from Wilton. He's very much with us on this issue. And so I would say those three are the ones that we'll be looking to. This is a short session, which means that individual legislators can't raise a bill. It has to come from the committees. So we'll be working very closely with Mike D'Amico again to make sure that he gets a bill in early and gets a hearing as soon as possible on that bill.
And so just to review what happened to the bill last time, it was raised in a committee, is that correct?
It was raised in the Environment Committee, and it actually came out of the Environment Committee with only two no votes, which was tremendous. It was bipartisan. And at that time, the Farm Bureau had not even submitted testimony. They, I think, thought this was a joke. It was going to go nowhere. And then once they saw it come out of committee, that's when they started to really come after the bill. And they actually said it was killing that bill was their number one priority for the session. So it got out of committee, and it was going to be called on the floor. It was on the supposed go list. That's what they call it. But it just kept getting blocked. And we still believe that it was the Farm Bureau and the Commissioner of Agriculture that ultimately blocked it from passing this year. And then we just ran out of time.
Well, thank you so much for that update, Tara Cook-Littman. We are down to our last moments here on the Organic Farm Stand. We will be back in 2 weeks. We'll have some more great programming coming up for you then. I want to thank Chris Ferriero, Guy Beardsley, Maggie Tebbets, and, of course, Tara Cook-Littman. My name is Richard Hill. And join us again next show. That'll be on August, let's see.
15th.
Thank you, guys.
I had 14 and 1.
The numbers man, always. And stay tuned for Peter Beauchamp's All Mixed Up coming up next. We'll talk to you all soon. Some announcements, and then Peter Beauchamp.
Well, I can tell by the look in your eyes, baby. You need the one thing that I can prescribe. Organic love, 100% natural, baby.